Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
You know, we spend so much time in the office, late nights, and even weekends. There's never enough time at home with family and friends, right? Well, there is a way to strike a balance. Get your work done and spend more time at home with GoToMyPC. With just a click, you can instantly access your office computer from any internet connection. GoToMyPC, brought to you by Citrix, is the easiest remote access service available. Improve your work life and really create some balance with GoToMyPC. And in fact, you can try it free for 30 days. For this special offer, you have to visit www.gotomypc.com/podcast. That's gotomypc.com/podcast for a free trial. And welcome aboard to the Disciplined Investor Podcast. This is Andrew Horowitz. Thanks for joining me today. And we have lots to talk about today. I brought on board an expert when it comes to mutual funds and now ETFs, Tim Middleton, who is a columnist for MSN Money. And a gentleman who I met recently at the Money Show out, where was I? Is it D.C., I guess? Was it D.C.? No. Forget where I'm traveling to these days. Oh, in Orlando. That's where it was. Mickey Mouseville. I thought I'd talk to you about a couple of different things and then get right into this discussion with him. Also, next week, we have coming up one of the senior vice presidents of TradeStation talk about some of the tools of the trade. I outlined that in my in the final chapter of my book called Tools of the Trade. So be it. And again, thank you so much for everybody who has put in iTunes comments. Thank you very much for heading over to iTunes and putting in your review and also sending me all those emails that we put together in our last episode, which discussed much of the successes that you've had becoming a disciplined investor. So now what I thought I'd just mention to you is a really interesting week that we saw last week. Obviously, we saw an unbelievable event by the Fed releasing about $1.2 trillion to flush into the economy in the form of expenditures on a whole host of things, buying up some of the assets that they talked about, particularly buying treasuries. Next week we have Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, supposedly going to come in with a plan finally, after all this time. We'll see what it looks like. Already we have a variety of congressional-like senators, et cetera, calling for his resignation. Latest, I think, was Senator Shelby. Connie Mack was prior to that calling for his head and his ouster. And frankly, we've seen President Obama's approval rating dropping recently, and that's only to be expected when he hasn't miraculously fixed the whole entire problem within, 60 days or so? But one of the things I thought was interesting was that we're seeing an announcement by Barclays Bank, who's having a lot of trouble, of course, over in the UK, and they're talking about selling their ETF unit, one of the most profitable units that they have. And I think what that means is that there could be a sea change of that we're going to see now. One of the things that I've kind of hoped for was that many mutual fund companies will start to buy the ETFs. Now, I hope they don't just buy them and squash them because they find they're not as profitable as the mutual fund business. But what I hope to happen, what I really hope to happen, is that they will buy them and then start instituting them inside of the 401k plans. So we get some true diversification as well as some inverse ETFs inside of the mix. One of the things that I did want to talk to you about was an issue about two things, actually. Number one, what happened last week after the announcement? And the second thing, what happens when we see companies starting to have problems with their dividends? And is that going to cause a gigantic problem in terms of returns on the markets in the next kind of phase of this market move? Are we going to see a leg down? Are we going to see a leg up? So now, here's the point. We saw that massive move up, clearly a short cover by every indication, right? One of the key components of a short covering rally is a very, very quick and parabolic move up. We've seen that in the last couple of weeks with the markets in anticipation of some broad and very bold moves by the government. We've seen that by the Fed now, probably. If Bernanke before threw in the kitchen sink, at this point, the entire house is being thrown in. This looks like one of a last-ditch efforts to get this whole party moving, credit flowing, et cetera. And I'll tell you again, and I'll repeat this because it bears mentioning, that when it comes to credit, I scratch my head and wonder that wasn't it the credit crisis that got us into this mess in the first place? And now all of a sudden we want to expend more credit in order to get us out of this mess? It doesn't make any sense. We need supposedly housing prices to level off and bottom. But wait a second, folks. We're finishing a piece right now, which we will have on the Disciplined Investor website shortly. What we're saying, why is it so important for everyone to own a home? What happened to renting? You know, in the good old days before, you would rent a house or rent an apartment until such time that you were able to afford a home, and then you would go out and you buy a home. Now it seems that everybody needs to go buy a home. What we found, one of the most interesting things that we found was that the average age of a homeowner over the last 30 years has dramatically reduced. In other words, what that means is over the last couple of three decades, what we have found is that the age in which people would own homes has gotten lower. Now, for all of those listening out there, they're in their early 20s to mid 20s and maybe early 30s. Let me just say something here. First of all, my birthday was last week. I turned around 44 on Friday. And you know what? I'm not so far away from those days, but I'll share this with you, that my financial future was not grounded very well back then. I didn't know where I was going to exactly be when I was in my early 20s. And you know what? At that time, I shouldn't have been buying a house. I shouldn't have gone and risked my financial future because I wanted to buy a house. And honestly, I think this is a really bad decision and a bad benchmark to be shooting for, to have everybody in their house. This is what caused the problem in the first place. Barney Frank, back a number of years ago, and a few of his constituents and people that were on this team of rah-rah, sis-boom-bah, let's get a house for everybody right now. I mean, they made a very, very bad mistake. And I think they're making the same mistake again. And we're all buying into this and saying, yeah, sure, we got to solve the housing problem. One of the ways is that to get this crisis under wraps is to slow down the problems we have and sell off all the inventory. And at the same time, miraculously, the builders keep on building. I mean, what is wrong with this picture? If you've heard me before and talk about builders, I use this. I say, builders are like puppy dogs. Puppy dogs will eat until they just absolutely puke. They throw up, they get sick, and they can't eat anymore. Builders will build until they bankrupt themselves over and over again. We have seen in the last report that was put out last, I think it was Wednesday, maybe it was Thursday, we saw a housing number. We saw a spike up in the housing numbers. But you know what? It was for non-single family homes. It was for multi-dwelling occupancy structures. And in other words, apartment buildings. Now, we are seeing a move back to renting. But at the same time, let's not view that as a wonderful enlightened look at the future. This is not the future. The fact that people are buying homes or not, the fact that home prices are stabilizing is a different discussion, but buying homes is not an indication that the economy is healthy again, okay? Unemployment went up again. We're at 8.1% overall, and we're seeing it continually climb, and it doesn't look like there's a stop in that at all in the near future. Don't let the quadruple witching hour week shenanigans of the Fed force you into believing that everything is fine. The all clear signal is there. A couple of weeks ago, we talked about getting your toes in the water and the long side of the equation. I got to tell you something. I'm getting a little concerned right now with the sell-off in the markets on the final 2 days of the week after we saw Bernanke come out with that historic number. We saw the dollar drop against the euro from about 129 to about 136. Immediately, we saw gold move up by about $65 an ounce. The markets moved up about 3% on the day of the announcement and then dropped back towards the end of the day to only finish up about 1.5%, I believe it was. And all told, the momentum seemed to have shifted dramatically, realizing that the Fed pushed the panic button. The Fed panicked. That's what happened. They saw a look into the future and said, oh my, we need to do something dramatic here because the unemployment rate isn't moving at all. The fact that we're still seeing housing prices tumble, no stabilization there, no stabilization with the credit markets. And on top of that, by the way, folks, the final thing that's really kind of causing problems is the uncertainty and indecisions of the Treasury, even though Geithner is supposedly coming out with some plan this week. But there has been no takers for the private and public equity moves in terms of there is a new plan that's going to combine private funds with public. And there's been an opening where I think $150 billion was available to help out, and only $4 billion was tagged by institutions to be utilized. I mean, that is not a good sign from what they're seeing here. So we're still seeing a drawdown overall. Durable goods orders slowed. CPI is creeping up a little bit, but that's not a sign of inflation at this point. It's a sign of although inflation is around the corner, of course, with the kind of spending that we're seeing right now. So all the things don't add up still, so don't get suckered in right now. Sure, you want to play these and trade these rallies and moves, fine. But as a long-only player where you're buying and holding, if you're still in that camp, folks, I think it's time to start taking a little bit off the table or to hedge that position even stronger than you had before. Because by all means and by all calculations that I could see, I had a conversation with the head of Standard & Poor's Equities last week, and we looked at the S&P 500 earnings numbers, and they were about $50 per share. Well, right now we have about a 15 multiple or 16 multiple on it right now when we get our shares up to about 775 or so on the S&P. But you know what? 15 or 16 PE in a time period like we're seeing now, which is supposed to be, equated to the difficulties and the problems we had back in the quote-unquote Great Depression of the 30s, we did not see an S&P 500 PE anywhere near this. You pull that back to 10, we're talking about 500 on the S&P, utilizing just very simplistic mathematical, equation here. But even if we're talking about a 14 on this and a 50 on the earnings, you know what? What are we talking about here? We're talking about a 700 at best on the S&P 500. So I don't know if we should be getting too excited about being in the markets right now. And frankly, I wonder if this is going to be a trap moving forward where we're sucked in right up to the 800 point on the S&P 500 like we saw recently. And then we saw that confluence of the Fibonacci retracements at about 775, the 20-day moving average, 50-day moving average, kind of getting really close to all these, and everything kind of stopped on a dime and turned around last week on the technicals. So let's be very, very careful not to get sucked in. Do not get complacent right now. That's what I'm telling you. I think it's a trader's market again, and I think that we're not going to see anything more than that. Now, in terms of the ETF discussion, very quickly, I think that we're going to see many mutual fund companies adopting ETFs or starting ETFs moving forward because it's really the right things to do for their customers. You can't have people just buying and holding, and if they want to get out, waiting until 4 o'clock in the afternoon. But I've talked about that too many times. Anyway, I thought what we'd do is we'd get on the horn with my friend here, Tim Middleton, and ask him some questions regarding his thoughts on ETFs and his thoughts on mutual funds and which way to go and his thoughts on the markets. And again, next week we're going to have some tools for trading with TradeStation. I think you'll enjoy that. And if you haven't done so already, last week's episode we had a list of some ideas for short and long positions. Go get that. There's an Excel spreadsheet. And listen to last week's episode to actually get the code to open up that Excel spreadsheet. It's right in the show notes. All right, when we get back, we're going to be on the horn with Tim Middleton, MSN Money, expert in ETFs and mutual funds. Stick around. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Onward and upward, folks. We are here with Tim Middleton, and he is an investment columnist with MSN Money. I met him recently at the Money Show for the first time, and he also writes for the ETF Insider newsletter, a great newsletter that I think that you ought to pick up. And I thought what we'd talk about is a few different things. First of all, I thought that we would talk about one of his recent articles and some of the things that are kind of swirling around these days. We've been talking about a lot. This whole idea of buy and hold is really being questioned these days. So, Tim, first of all, thank you for joining us today.
Well, thank you, Andy.
So tell me, this whole assault, this whole attack on buy and hold, which was kind of a topic that was very much off limits for a long time. What are we to make of this? Because, I mean, I know from my side of things what I think, and we've been kind of blathering about this for a long time. But, you know, from your side, where you kind of do a lot of work in the ETF world and mutual funds, I mean, how does that play into that discussion?
Well, buy and hold is an effective strategy in a market in which equities are delivering positive returns. Buy and hold is not an effective strategy in a market in which equities are not returning positive returns. Mm-hmm. That's the kind of market we've had for more than a decade now.
Yeah.
I don't care what your time frame is, that's a long time. That's a long-term horizon.
Exactly.
So if you believe the idea that you should just sit there and take what the market dishes about, I think modern circumstances is teaching you that that doesn't work. Buy and hold is great for a long-term bear market, but in any other situation, you've got to be more proactive.
Right. Well, one of the things that I've always suggested, and it's interesting because I've targeted a few people. We'll target not so much Warren Buffett today, you know, brilliant as he is and as rich as he is. Number two now, not number one, though. And, you know, I want to take like a John Bogle, who, you know, he again, a brilliant guy, built this wonderful, family funds, the Vanguard funds. And, you know, he preaches buy and hold. But, I mean, I think, quite frankly, he's a bit biased. I mean, if he starts talking about selling and moving in and out of things, number one, it's against his principle, but number two, it's against his entire, you know, bottom line for his company.
Exactly. It's against his economic interest.
Yeah.
The mutual fund industry makes money on funds under management. It's in their interest that you don't trade. They want you to give them your money and then just keep giving them money and leave it with them. So you just have to understand your interest and their interests can come together, but they're not identical.
Mm-hmm. So to get around that, what are you suggesting? ETFs? What is kind of things that you're teaching, especially for newer investors? Because, you know, it's one thing for someone who's working all day in the markets and working the markets. Another thing for somebody else who's working a job throughout the day, and how do they really deal with this?
Sure. I think for the average investor, mutual funds cannot be beat. The problem with ETFs is that you have to pay commissions to buy and sell them.
Mm-hmm.
And forgive me, I've got an extra phone here in my office going off, and I can't shut it off, but it'll
Don't worry about it. We'll just keep talking over it.
So for most investors, the total cost of ownership is more favorable for mutual funds. But that doesn't mean that you just sit there and watch it go down. You have to follow the rules of the organization. I think the mutual fund company that offers the best mix of funds and liberal rules is T. Rowe Price.
Yeah, I
have to have my largest investment retirement account there. But setting that aside, any mutual fund company you can work with, especially when you're younger, starting out, and you don't have lump sums. Once you start to get to the stage where, like, you're rolling over a 401k,
mm-hmm.
when you've got lump sums or you're investing substantial sums, you know, thousands rather than tens or hundreds of dollars, then ETFs become more attractive.
Now, the problem that I have is that, you know, there are ways to buy ETFs very economically. I mean, we work with, to be honest with you, it's so cheap, it's ridiculous. It may cost you a dollar per transaction. It's ridiculously cheap. Whereas you have, you know, some of the other big companies, they charge you a lot. Now, the bigger problem I have with mutual funds is they're imposing short-term trading fees. I have someone who recently put money in mutual funds, and if they get out, they charge a 2% fee on the back end as a penalty. In other words, they're imposing their will of how you should invest with them and the timing to make sure that they get their money's worth from you. I think it's disgusting.
Well, that's right. If you can find a very low-cost entry point for ETFs, then great. That's good for you.
Right.
But most of us have to pay commissions of some kind.
Yeah.
At least until we've got an account that's pretty substantial in size.
Yeah. So when I recently read some of your articles, you had a couple of things. You had the three safe ways to start investing again. That was just a couple of days ago. And you talked about something that we've all been talking about, I think, is the whole idea of market bottoms. I think it is hysterical how many people have the innate need to call the market bottom. I mean, is it? It's like a comedy, isn't it?
Well, yeah, you know, it's like picking the final four. You just we get our animal spirits going, our competitive juices.
Right, but picking them in the beginning of the year.
So you and I will study charts and try to figure out whether the bottom is going to be 752 on the S&P,
right.
And we derive some pleasure out of this. The way the ordinary person should look at it is, are stocks expensive or are they cheap?
Right.
And right now they're cheap.
Right. Well, not all stocks are cheap, but yes, many of them are cheap. But the problem is a greater issue. Let's kind of get into this. The story of, are we any longer a free market economy? And more so, not even a free market economy. Are we a free market in terms of the equity markets and the fixed income markets? You know, recently this week we saw helicopter Ben fly in and dump $1.25 trillion sprinkled around from his left pocket to his right pocket. Market reacted favorably at first, but the other thing is that we are seeing the interesting public outcry, pitchforks, flamethrowers, the concern. Did you see there was a concern about the safety of the people if they revealed the names of who was getting bonuses at AIG?
Yes, and you know, the first thing that occurred to me is you've seen those articles in the New York Times showing a couple of poor, unfortunate Chinese men on their knees
yep.
in some public square, and the authorities are shaming them before they cut their heads off.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is not China over here, is it? We don't do this to people. This is, you know, this is the kind of stuff that ten-horn dictators pull.
Mm.
This is Hugo Chavez
right.
politics.
Mm-hmm.
It's a scandal. It's an outrage. It's not capitalism. And fortunately, it's going to be fleeting. This is a bunch of, frankly, left-wing politicians having a little fun at the expense of something they don't basically like, which is capitalism.
Well, what's interesting is that we're all, you know, bitching and moaning about, you know, 100 and, I don't know, whatever, 150, 170 million dollars, then they're talking about cutting it in half. And I mean, that's pretty gross. We know that the amount of money and the amount of problems that AIG cost us, and I think that recently that we're talking about an unwind that's going to take 4 years and a total of about $1.5 trillion, I think the total number on the AIG unwind is. My bigger concern is, you know, we're seeing this, you know, we're seeing this face. This is what's touching us personally, right?
Well, to look at it a different way, the total amount of bonuses paid at AIG is less than the average size earmark put in by a congressman in this year's budget.
Right.
It's a joke.
So why are they so upset?
AIG very well, Ace Greenberg, you remember, was ridden out of town on a rail by a politician, Elliot Ness. Elliot Spitzer. Because good old American Puritanism, and he was sure a Puritan, wasn't he?
It was lily white.
So it's obscene, it's political theater. This is the stuff for people like, what's that guy on cable TV, Stewart?
John Stewart?
John Stewart.
I was on his show this week. Did you see me? Did you catch me on his show?
I'm sorry, I did not. I don't watch that guy. I apologize.
Let's put it this way, that it was an interesting discussion about short selling. We had a little sidebar discussion with Samantha Bee, and they talked about short selling, and they made kind of an interesting discussion out of it after the Kramer episode, and then, but they cut it together and made it almost look like that short selling is the reason why companies fail, and they seemingly forgot to point out that the reason why companies fail is because companies fail. They don't do well, and financially, they don't stay afloat. You know, naked short selling is one thing. Traditional short selling is an entirely different discussion. And frankly, to start feeding people the idea that short selling is a bad thing is once again bringing them back right back to buy and hold, and just you're only allowed to make money if the markets go up, which is just ridiculous.
Well, of course it is. And going back to the only bear market worse than the one we're in now, the one that started in 1929,
mm-hmm.
Three Americans each made $100 million in the crash of 1929. Joe Kennedy,
mm-hmm.
Bernard Baruch,
mm-hmm.
and Jesse Livermore.
Yep.
They were all short the market. And Congress hauled them up, I think it was 1931, and pilloried them for their lack of patriotism. And the fact is, all they were doing was recognizing the handwriting on the wall. And by the way, it turned out to be a kind of a deeply patriotic act, because Joe Kennedy used part of his proceeds to buy the presidency for his son, JFK.
And then eventually Jesse Livermore maybe was so moved by this, he decided that he better get back into the market, and that didn't work out so well for him.
Yeah, Jesse went bankrupt 11 times. I'm sorry, 7 times. And I think 1932 was the fourth.
Mm.
Poor guy kept breaking his own rules.
Yep. Now, here's my question to you, because you talk about discipline. You know, we are disciplined here on the Discipline Investor Podcast. I mean, we better be, or it's just a name. But I want to ask you something about the bonuses, and let me just interject one point. What's interesting is that I don't think the outcry is great enough when it comes to, let's say, a Goldman and a JP Morgan, where they were the ones that initially got most of the money or a good chunk of the money on the initial bailout. People don't know, most people probably don't know the writing of this that has recently come out that shows that about a $30 billion initial payment to AIG went direct to counterparties, which is much spookier than $175 million bonuses being paid.
Well, of course, most of the money, implicit in the entire bailout concept is that the money goes to counterparties, and the counterparties, by and large, are hedge funds. So this federal money is building bigger mansions in Greenwich, Connecticut, whether you like it or not.
Yep.
But that's how the system works, and it's really, it's not a particularly useful conversation because it doesn't advance the ball. The ball is that Mr. and Mrs. America have to have confidence they can buy a home and find a job and buy a car. And that confidence is lacking right now. And that has very little to do with this this little sidebar to the story. The story is the Federal Reserve, and so far it's acting pretty responsibly.
But at the same time, how does an investor, an average investor, have any confidence? Because at this point, it's no longer a free market environment that we're working in. And you have to handicap what the Fed is going to do. By the way, I'm not quite sure that at $1.2 or $1.5 trillion is entirely responsible, but it may be necessary. I don't know if it's responsible. And I don't know if those are mutually exclusive, by the way. But how does your average investor have the ability to have confidence in the markets if there is this entirely underhanded operation that seems to be going on? When we saw the move on the Fed, we saw that also an hour before, 2 hours before, there were huge bets on call options, betting that this kind of situation will happen. There was a spike up on the euro in the morning. I mean, this is a major spike, not just a move up. It was a gap up in the morning of this happening. One can only think that there is some kind of, leakage going on. And then even if that's not happening, how does your average investor, get back to this, have confidence in anything that is so outside the controls of a free market?
Well, we've lived in a relatively controlled marketplace our whole lives. We're not living laissez-faire capitalism. We never have. We're not as socialistic as the Europeans, but we're a heck of a lot more socialistic than America was before the Great Depression. The issue, I think, for the average investor is to simply try to be skeptical and keep in mind your own interests and those of the government can divert. So we own an ETF called Spider Gold Shares, ticker symbol GLD. We also own an ETF called Ultra Short 20-Plus Year Treasury, ticker symbol TBT, because...
That got walloped.
Yes, it did. It's getting crushed. But the Fed cannot do this forever. The Fed can only do this for a while. And while they're doing it, they're propping up the value of long-term treasuries. But at the moment they withdraw, those things are going to collapse. They're in a bubble. Warren Buffett pointed this out in his annual letter to his shareholders. And so I can't predict what day this fund is going to start taking off, but I can confidently predict that it will.
Yep.
And that's the attitude I think we investors have to adopt, that what the Fed is doing, they are bringing down mortgage interest rates. That's very good. They are putting a floor under housing. That's very important to our economy. 70% of Americans are homeowners. That's part of the American dream. So that's a good thing, but it has a bad thing in its trail, and that's inflation, and that means you want to own things like commodities and gold.
So now, just to totally bring back the discussion of buy and hold for a moment, now, I understand that you have these feelings. Let's just focus for one moment on the gold shares that you own, just for a hypothetical discussion. So you own this gold shares. Is there a point, even though you have this belief, this belief that gold will do well over time because of all the different factors that you bring to the discussion, is there a time then that you don't stay with it? I mean, what do we say that, you know what? Yes, diversification is good. We need to have a lot of different things. Commodities now, because hard assets are good in the face of a weakening dollar, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What is the cue then that we have to give people to say, maybe not the exact point, but an idea, we're not buying and holding forever here. We're buying and holding till we think the story changes.
Well, that's right. You know, gold is not an investment. Gold is always a trade. You know, it's been one of the worst investments of the last generation. But it's been a fairly reliable store of value over literally thousands of years. So my feeling is that gold, we bought it in the low 900s. Mm-hmm. My feeling was that it was attractively priced at that point. I think that gold is going to go up to X, and I don't know what X is, but it's certainly going to be 50% more than it is now, something like that. And there will come a point, just as there came a point in the 1970s and the early 1980s, when people won't tolerate inflation anymore. And when that point comes, that'll be the time to dump hard assets. But until that day comes, and that day is years in the future, hard assets are going to be a good thing to own.
So what is it that we should not be near? I mean, what is it that is glaringly... we have been short the mutual fund companies, for example, as maybe as distasteful as that may seem to you, being you know, liking mutual funds, but it seems to me that they're losing a lot. T. Rowe Price, as an example, excellent group, excellent fund family in terms of offerings and availability of low fees. But the problem is that they have, I think there's going to be a huge infiltration of ETFs and other assets potentially into 401k plans that may be slicing into that. And to top that off, these companies are obviously losing assets left and right. They're losing a lot of assets, and that's the bread and butter, of course. So, I mean, are mutual fund companies going to be, I don't think we can deny the fact there'll be less of them in the future, less companies?
Yes, they're under enormous competitive pressure, but I should tell you, my investment style is more top-down rather than bottom-up, and therefore I really don't know too much about companies, so I don't follow, like, individual companies or industries.
Okay, I gotcha.
But my prejudice is that in the coming decade or so, investors will benefit from being exposed to hard assets, from being exposed to other currencies other than the U.S. dollar, and to the place where the greatest growth is occurring. Domestically, that's in small and mid-sized companies. And internationally, it's also in those companies, and it's also in emerging markets.
So we recently had on, Dr. Doom, who is...
Mark Faber?
Mark Faber. We had him on 2 weeks ago, I want to say, on the show, and he was talking about that, the same discussion. There's a variety of people talking about that. What about U.S. equities? I mean, I'm not asking you to call a bottom here, but does it appear to you that we are fairly valued? And let me just add this one point. We have researched and seen, again, I had a conversation with the lead analyst over at S&P this week for equities, and we're looking at somewhere in the range of, I'm going to be kind, $50 per share earnings into 2009, and not much better in 2010, projected right now at about a 15 or 16 PE multiple, which is extraordinarily high just by the standard of where we are in our economic climate. But again, just to be fair, we'll just say we'll stick a 15 PE on a 50 multiple on a 50 earnings, and we get 750 on the S&P as a fair valuation. There's some discussion that that's quite lofty at this point, that we should be more like a 12. Let's not go down to a 10. Let's just say a 12, a 12, again, just to multiplying it out, we're at a 600. Do you think that, we are fairly valued at this point, considering all the things that are happening?
Well, I would say that I hate to weasel around on this point because I realize how important it is, but that's a question of investor psychology. Yep. that I don't know how to read those tea leaves. I haven't figured out any kind of systematic way of understanding that kind of market psychology in the aggregate. All I can look at is valuations in relative terms. Mm-hmm. And in relative terms, I think the market, the U.S. market, is pretty attractive. I think emerging markets are even more attractive, but not by an order of magnitude or something. They're maybe 10 or 20% more attractive than the domestic market. I think the domestic market is very attractive. I think U.S. investors, generally speaking, should have a majority of their equity assets in U.S. assets. But, of course, some of those U.S. assets can be things like oil companies, which are really commodity bets. But I do think that the recent strength of the dollar will turn out to be an aberration. and that we're going to go back to what obtained between 2002 and 2007, which was a 35% decline in the value of the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see how we can escape that with our current account deficits. And that means we have higher oil.
Yeah, higher oil prices.
Go overseas.
Yeah, and then we have higher oil prices. By the way, again, that summary leads me to believe that it's a questionable area that we're in, whether it's today, tomorrow, last week. I'm not trying to pinpoint the top or bottom either. I'm just saying that all roads lead to a concerning factor. You know, if we have a weakening dollar over time, it means that the government's going to keep on flushing us with cash and pushing things in to drop down the dollar. And of course, that's a comparative issue because we have the it's only down or up compared to something. But the second thing is we have oil. You know, and dollar down, oil up is clear. And all that leads me to believe that this shake, I just don't think, let's put it this way. Let's talk about a big picture for a minute. I don't think the shakeout in the markets are over. It is not green light, smooth sailing for the near term. I'm not talking about 5 years down the road for a moment. I'm just talking about the near term. It is clear to me that it's not done with. Would you give me that?
I agree with you absolutely. In our portfolios at ETF Insider, we are we have very little equity exposure, except through corporate bonds, both high grade and junk bonds. I think the way to have equity exposure to the U.S. right now is through corporate bonds. They are very inexpensive relative to treasuries. They have rallied nicely. Even the junk bonds are beginning to rally, although I think we're early on them. To go back to this issue of buy and hold, the buy and hold investor is predominantly equities all the time. This mm-hmm. is not a good regime to be predominantly equities. This is a good regime to be predominantly fixed income.
Regime. Good use of a word. Regime. I like that.
Well,
you know, and also in closing, Michael Brush over at MSN also, which I haven't had the opportunity to speak to him, but he wrote an article, it's front page this week, that says the five, I think it's called the five myths, the five lies, the five somethings, that, I don't know if you read it yet, that investors are being thrown, basically the buy and hold, probably, buy on the dips. I'm sure there's a few of other things in there that are interesting. And I would like to say that, at least my experience, I write for MSN in terms of the blog and the strategy lab that I've done and all that. It's been very interesting to me that Microsoft has allowed, and you may know this, but I think it's interesting, that has allowed for such a great level of cynicism, but also of questioning something that is pretty sacred, you know, and not only the buy and hold, but in every area, and gives us such a great leash, an opening leash. In other words, lets us do whatever we want in terms of exploring these areas. And I think that is extremely, it really is something that should be applauded.
Well, it is indeed. And let me tell you, as a I've been writing about financial markets my entire career, and publishers who are willing to be that open are relatively rare.
Mm-hmm.
Publishers often take a point of view, and they'll be pro-equity, for example, or they'll be pro-fixed income.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't have that problem at Microsoft, thank goodness.
Yeah, I'll summarize in this one point. I wrote a piece last year last summer, I was, people refer to me as a lunatic, but basically I was all over this whole issue of the oil mess when it was reaching 135 or so, and screaming from the top of my lungs and how this was all being a big setup scam and manipulated. And I wrote an article for Business Week, and we talked about the whole idea of the Enron loophole. And I got it back saying, we can't talk about the Enron loophole. People wouldn't understand it. And I said, wait a minute, I've explained it in the paragraph below. And you need to put that in because people need to understand what's going on here. They pulled it. And I said, what's the point of writing about this to educate and help people out to understand something if you're going to pull it? Unbelievable.
Yeah.
All right, well, let me in closing, tell everybody, listen, do me a favor. I want you to make sure to read this man's work, Tim Middleton, over at one of the investment columnists at MSN Money. He's going to be – are you going to be in Vegas, by the way?
Yes, I will be at the Money
All
Show.
All right. We're going to have to get together and belly up to the bar and say hello to each other again.
Good deal.
I encourage you, we'll put a link on the website to get his newsletter, the ETF Insider. And I think now I've been talking about it for a long time. The opportunity to invest in something like an ETF over a mutual fund, I do tell you, I think it's a very wise move. And to have a guide like Tim to help you along with that, I think can't be better. So thank you so much, ETF Insider, and get your subscription today.
Andy, thank you very much.
All right, we'll talk soon, my friend. Be well. Bye-bye.
Thank you.
I think that was very interesting. I mean, Here's a guy that really knows his stuff when it comes to ETFs, and I would encourage you to go check out his newsletter. You know, that's going to wrap it up for today. And if you have any questions, of course, write me at askandrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com. And I asked you before, and I'll ask you again, if you haven't picked up a copy of my book, The Disciplined Investor, $13 or so over at Amazon, available on Kindle now too, folks, and audiobook as well through Audible or the iTunes store. Go pick that up. I think you'll learn a couple of things there, and a lot of things we talk about here are, you know, probably going to give you a little bit of backdrop drop to some of that. And we're going to continue of giving some of the individual stock and the ETF tips as we go along. We're kind of setting up a kind of a new structure here so we can actually, you know, give you those on a regular basis. One last thing, if you haven't done so, if you want to hear a discussion with John Dvorak and myself, dhunplug.com. That is a podcast that we do. It's kind of a sneak peek into the discussions that we have. Kind of we turn on the phones and just have a really neat discussion. So check that out. You can go to dhunplug.com and, you know, subscribe to that through iTunes as well. Until next week, I'll see you soon. Have a safe week. It should be an interesting one. We have GDP coming out this week and a whole host of other mind-breaking, altering, and crazy things when it comes to the Fed, Geithner, the government. And we're going to probably hear a lot of yammering and discussion from our politicians this week that should be very interesting. Be careful not to get sucked into it, and strap on, because I think we're
the Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz and Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager.
The
information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.